I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
You're listening to Text Message, the UK-focused technology podcast with me, Nate Langson.
And me, a bunged-up Ian Morris.
If you're one of our patrons, this is your extended ad-free version of this week's show. And if you're not yet a patron but we'd like to get our ad-free and extended versions, listen and interact with us live like we have people doing right now, and hello to the chat room. You can get involved by heading to patreon.com/UK Tech. Get instant access. Instant. It's like a knife attack, just straight away. No waiting around. One thing I wanted to point out is just that we've had quite a few new patrons joining us over the last few weeks, and I wanted to do a bit of a reminder to anyone who is on our Patreon feed that there is a separate RSS feed just for you guys that delivers the ad-free extended version. It's also in a higher audio quality, but you have to replace your existing free one. Many of you may have already done that, but I just wanted to make sure that everyone was aware that there'll be an email in your inbox welcoming you, and it has an RSS link. But drop us an email, hello@techpodcast.uk, if you have any problems or questions about that. And welcome to Diogo Santos and Charlotte Stegall, who are our most recent patrons who joined us since the last show we did. So thank you very much to you and everyone else who's supporting us.
Warm welcomes.
Attempts to increase the number of people shopping on UK high streets has been given a boost by search giant Google. It's teamed up with a startup called Near Street to help consumers see what's available in their local shops via the web, the BBC wrote this week. The search results will also help tell people the distance from where they are to the shop and also the price of goods for sale, obviously. The technology works, it's quite clever, by connecting to a retailer's point of sale system, so it knows the inventory they've got at any exact moment, extracting that data and then showing in real time what stock they have and at what price. This, again, according to the BBC, which means that the live inventory system should make it easy to shop as locally as online, at least according to Google. Initially, Near Street focused on shops in London, no surprises there, but since the partnership with Google was announced, they said they intend to roll the technology out to high streets around the UK over the next year, and particularly, they say, there will be a focus on small retailers and independent stores, which obviously is great news for those companies trying to compete with the likes of Amazon and others. To put this all into context, obviously we've had a lot of fears in over recent years. Ooh, it's a poet. I'm a poet, and I didn't realise that the high street is dying, but both local and national shops are struggling to make profits. I mean, Ian, you must have seen, as well as anyone and myself, the number of vacant storefronts that are just being turned into vaping shops in particular. And according to the Office of National Statistics, and I didn't realise this figure until I was researching this story, that online sales in the UK actually only account for about 18% of total retail sales in Britain. So more than 80% is still done in the high street. But interestingly, according to another couple of studies that I looked up, that figure is only about 10% in the US this year. So there's basically twice as many people in the UK are shopping online than in person.
Interesting.
Yeah,
I think we have it pretty good in the UK, though. I think our online shopping is much faster because geographically there are fewer challenges.
Yeah, I think in the US, the Amazon Prime delivery is like free 2-day, whereas in Britain, it's often same day or next day. And in sometimes within 2 or 3 hours, I've had printer ink cartridges sent to me very, very quickly. But this is good news. I mean, to me, it makes a lot of sense that Google would want to do this. I mean, I think also to fend off any accusations that it's helping cripple the high street, and B, perhaps also to challenge Amazon a little bit. You know, if people can come to Google in order to find local shopping results that they can go out and pick up that day, maybe there's less desire for those same people to try and go on Amazon and give them more money, which, you know, although it benefits Google, it is probably good for the high street. What do you think?
Well, I do. I can say that I honestly do believe that this is quite a good idea, because ultimately, if you can find a shop near you that has what you want, then it's you're going to choose that, aren't you, really? Because it's much nicer to walk in somewhere and to walk away with a product. You know, Amazon is about sort of convenience, isn't it? You know, it's being able to search for something and being able to press a button and have it delivered. But you still have to wait, and that might not always be useful. Particularly, I mean, you just said you bought a hard drive. I've done that in the past, where a hard drive has, you know, exploded during I've been doing something or whatever, and I've really not wanted to wait even a day to get a new one. It would be much better if I could type it in and find out a local high street store that stocked that, or that I could get to. So yeah, from that perspective, it's great. I also sort of feel like it, you know, no one wants to see what you just said, which is we're going towards having high streets that are quite desolate, in that there are a high percentage of shops which are coffee shops, vaping shops, whatever, charity shops, which is obviously fine. I mean, I'm not a big charity shop user, but I know a lot of people are. But, you know, so from that perspective, it's in our interest to try and encourage people to run shops on the high street. And it's nice to walk down, and obviously the two have to feed each other, don't they? If Google can feed into the high street, then we'll have nicer high streets. But, you know, at the same time, Google will still see benefit, because it will still be providing search results. So it's a good thing.
I think one of the challenges that Google will have is actually convincing some smaller independent retailers to get into bed and open up their point of sale system. I mean, I think Google is often lumped in with a lot of other internet giants like Amazon as kind of being the arbiter of the demise of the high street. And so Google coming along and saying, hey, why don't you link up your point of sale system so we can index, you know, what you have in your store, might be seen as something like a Trojan horse.
It also relies on those high street stores having good enough point of sale that they know their stock well enough. And that's probably true of the larger chains. But if you're talking about smaller sort of bespoke shops, I don't even know where you'd begin with that. But I don't know. I'm not a retailer, so I have no idea.
I think that Nick Gassman in the chat points something very interesting out, which is that he expects that clothes and shoes are more commonly shopped in the high street and electronics more online. And I think while that's probably true, if you look at the rise of companies like ASOS and Boohoo and Pretty Little Thing and all these kind of cheaper, well, they're not all cheap, but, you know, they're not necessarily luxury fashion retailers.
Yeah.
You know, they have risen enormously over the last few years. I mean, absolutely gigantic. And as we've discussed fairly recently, at the expense of some big high street chains like BHS and Marks and Spencer and Debenhams. And so there is definitely a shift to buying online because they have good return policies and the delivery's fast and convenient.
Well, that's a legally mandated thing, isn't it? I mean, there isn't any reason that you couldn't sort of take that. I mean, you know, distance selling rules have always been good. And that means that if something's not quite right when you get it, or you just decide you don't want it anymore, you can return it. I think if you offered that to people on the high street, although to be honest, most shops would take things back if they were presented in that condition.
But it feels like just the kind of thing that Google getting into bed with a local retailer, say a boutique retailer of clothes stores, that's something that Google can really push in a way that Amazon kind of can't. And I think that could be exactly the kind of result that the high street would benefit from, you know, with Google. You know, you can imagine going onto Google saying, okay, well, I know there are some clothes stores down there, but I don't know what they have. You can't really check anything like that online. You can't necessarily compare it, and you can't try anything on. But you go on Google and you find out, okay, well, this has got this in medium and it's got them in this color, and you can just pop down and try them on. And that feels like a very compelling offer, and not something, as I say, Amazon could ever really do with the same level of convenience. If you have any thoughts on this, do let us know. hello@techpodcast.uk. Have you experimented with this? Let us know. The gambling industry spending on marketing, Ian, surged to £1.5 billion in Britain last year, prompting renewed warnings, of course, about the impact that this has on children. But this news came days after a report revealed a steep rise in the number of under 18 problem gamblers, so kids with gambling addictions, The Guardian wrote this week. Now, what's interesting to us, of course, is just how much of this growth has actually been using social media as a way of targeting gamblers. The Guardian wrote that a study for GambleAware, which apparently is the UK's leading gambling charity, I'd never heard of it, but that's what The Guardian says.
Yes.
It found that betting companies have increased their marketing spend by 56% since 2014, with five times more money spent online now than on TV commercials. And then separately, but obviously relatedly, and this came, well, I saw it originally on Sky News, there was a report that video game loot boxes have been blamed for a, quote, deeply concerning rise in the number of children with gambling problems. There was another audit by the Gambling Commission that put the number of problem gamblers aged between 11 and 16 years old having reached 55,000, with a further 70,000 at risk, and 450,000 children who are said to be betting regularly. And the findings did note as well that there's close to a million young people apparently exposed to gambling through loot boxes and games. Now, this is all very, very interesting in its own right, but it also came out after Belgium, or rather the other way around, sorry, after Square Enix, a video game developer out of Japan, pulled three or four titles from the Belgian app stores because the European because Belgium had passed legislation basically cracking down on loot boxes earlier this year. So Square Enix said, you know, basically it's not viable to do business in that kind of environment, and they pulled the games, which included Mobius Final Fantasy, Kingdom Hearts Union X, and Dissidia Final Fantasy Opera Omnia. Very Japanese sounding video game titles there. And the company posted a statement as well in game saying that the present uncertain legal status of loot boxes under Belgian law was a reason for the game's removal. So let's take a step back. We've got a gigantic rise in online and digital spending to promote gambling. B, we've got more young children with gambling problems or facing having a gambling problem than we've ever had before. And C, or three, because I forget whether I use numbers or letters just now, we also have loot boxes really presenting themselves to be such a problem that games companies are basically pulling out of markets because the law's cracking down on them too harshly. That's everything that I wanted to discuss now, Ian. And I thought it was worth pointing out that I actually... I'm not in favor of the loot box.
Interesting.
I even though I've spent money on loot boxes, they are incredibly addictive. They are incredibly opaque in terms of the likelihood that you get what you want, and they can often be very, very expensive. Let's actually put this into a little bit of context for those of you who don't know what a loot box is. If you play a game, sometimes you pay for a game up front, sometimes you don't pay anything. It's a free-to-play game. And that's like the ones that Square Enix has pulled out of Belgium. And you can get additional in-game items. It might be costumes. It might be a level booster. It might be something that helps you in that game either be more competitive or look better or do something faster. And sometimes you can just buy those items. And other times you have to buy them in a container, a box, a chest, a pack of cards, something where there's a chance you might get the item you want, but you don't know. It's a little bit like the old playing trading cards when you buy a sticker collection and you get six stickers and you're hoping that you're going to get Chris Waddle. That's right. I only have a knowledge of that from Premier League 96, the old sticker collections, but other sports players are available, I guess. But the problem is now is that because this is tied in with in-app payments, it's being promoted so heavily with marketing on social media that is obviously very, very attractive to kids, it's really causing a problem. I feel, Ian, like I've been standing on a soapbox for the last 4 minutes.
Well, no, I mean, but I do find it quite interesting, and I sort of struggle with this a bit. So I'll lay out where I stand on it. I personally do not find them tempting. I find them actually quite repellent because I just, if I want to do something in a game, my first choice would be to do it through a natural achievement whereby you get better at the game and you get rewarded for that with things. That's especially the case when you've paid for a game. Obviously, I have in the past. I'm not doing it very much now, but I played Destiny 2, and it has an element of it sort of loot box, but it's always cosmetic things, which is fun but not necessary. So I can live with that because I don't feel tempted by those things so much. where it becomes a problem, like you say, is if it's giving you an achievement level up that you can't get anywhere, which is essentially pay to win. And I don't like that in any context. But of course, at the same time, we sort of have to recognise the fact that there are economic factors in that a lot of games don't charge for the game itself, and that they are, you know, subsist through in-app payments. And in amongst those are the games that are very, very popular with kids, which principally, I guess, is Fortnite, and perhaps a few other things that I haven't heard of or played. But from my perspective, I can sort of see the logic of financing the game that way, and it's been big business, right? You know, Fortnite's made something like $2 billion since it started, and that's for a game that's largely free. The bit that everyone's playing is free. So, you know, it's been good business for the company. They've kept it up to date. They've added new challenges. Everyone's having a good time playing the game. It's not mandatory. The loot boxes don't necessarily make it... they're not essential, but they probably do help in that game. Again, I'm not actually an expert. Like you say, though, there is an element of gambling to it, and that is troublesome, not just because of the financial implications of it, but because of what it's doing to the brains of the young people who are involved. And like you say, you know, I mean, I don't know how similar it is to other addictions. I mean, gambling is something I've never really been too bothered about. But I can, you know, with alcohol or smoking, you can see how those things become addictive. It's a pattern of behaviour that your brain gets used to. It's not so much about the substances themselves, although I suppose they are, arguably addictive in various ways.
But at the end of the day, mate, I mean, the thing is, what you're talking about is dopamine. And whether it's drugs, activities, it's the reward feedback loop.
Yes.
You know, you do something that you're stimulated by, and you get the dopamine release. It feels good, and that happens in gambling. That, yeah, you know, that crave to get the reward. It happens in with drugs and with alcohol or other behavior. And it's a very natural thing. And there are critics that say that it's not the same for gambling, but for gaming, but I actually think it is. I mean, I think it is.
I think, in fact, surely with gaming and in that regard, it's actually more so. I mean, the exhilaration you feel from doing something in a game is pretty. Well, there's a reason that gaming has become so popular. It is extremely rewarding, and I can sort of see that if you're really into a game, then being rewarded for, you know, paying for a loot box by, you know, something you've really won in game is going to be addictive.
And that's part of the problem here, because if you agree that the use of loot boxes qualifies as gambling, and for what it's worth, I did look up the dictionary definition of gambling on Google, and it says taking risky action in the hope of a desired result, which definitely I think qualifies loot boxes as gambling, then you've got this situation where not only are kids potentially more susceptible to gambling because they are seeing more adverts for it, but also the nature in which they are able to gamble, i.e. loot boxes, are getting more and more numerous and more accessible.
Yeah.
So I think that it's good that this study came out. You know, I probably sound like I have a slightly more conservative view on this than other things, but it's possibly born out of the fact that I've felt myself as someone who has had what could be classed, if not necessarily a gambling or video game addiction, but I have definitely played games and have spent quite a lot of money on loot boxes and loot box type things than actually I really think I should have done.
Yeah.
And I feel like I'm generally in control of it, but it's something I have to be quite aware of. I know that I've got a very addictive personality, and it's something I have to be mindful of. But I can, you know, at my age and with my knowledge and just enough self-restraint, I can tackle that. I feel I can tackle that. But can a 9-year-old who's let loose on their parents' iPad?
Well,
I don't.
And ultimately, this is the thing. I think, again, it's like so many things. It just comes back to parental control. There's no reason that 11 to 16-year-olds should be allowed to do loot boxes. There's no reason that they don't certainly have incomes. They don't have enough money in most cases.
Well, hang on a minute. No. I want to throw loot boxes a bone here, actually, because I remember when I was younger and I would be given, you know, my my pocket money or my allowance for the week, I was totally allowed and able to go down to the newsagent and buy, you know, two or three sticker packs to fill up whatever sticker collection I was making. That is basically a real world loot box, you know. It's and it was fine because I had a finite limited resource. I was told that when the money's gone, it's gone. But what I spent it on was up to me. And, and that was, I mean, to me, that feels fine, and that feels like what a loot box is here. If you're, if I don't have kids, but if I did, and I gave them some pocket money, and I said, well, you can spend it on a loot box if you want, but just be aware that you might not get what you want, and if you don't, you're not having any more. Then again, that feels like it's okay, but it shouldn't. No. I don't think we should I personally don't think we should necessarily say that your young kids shouldn't be buying loot boxes.
I agree, but I'm also troubled by the thing that we just discussed, in that there is an issue in that it could be doing bad things to them. But having said that, I'm not a scientist. I don't know if that's the case. I don't know how troubling it is. I think that there is a great gift that you can give children, that is being able to manage your own money, and knowing that there's a finite amount of it. It's one of the very very noticeable differences between young children and slightly older children, is that young children have no conception of what money is or where it comes from, and they don't understand that there's a limited amount of it. So teaching children that is essential if you want to have them with the tools they need as adults to not get themselves into crippling debt. But what concerns me more is, I think, the idea that these things are either that kids are being given too much money and having, because I don't think that you're in your example, going and buying one or two sticker packs a week, I don't think you're going to really hit yourself hard with an addiction that way. You know, you might look forward to it next week, or you might instead choose to spend your money on sweets. But ultimately, I think if you give kids too much of a, you know, too much of it. So, for example, if you give in and say, okay, you're going to have four loot boxes or whatever, I have no idea what the numbers would be. I feel like there is a limit, there is a line between, you know, just having some fun. And I don't think that gaming is quite the same as stickers. I think that the rewards are so much greater in that context, in that you either look the best out of your clan, or you've got tools or skills that other people don't have. And I just think it tips it slightly over the edge. It's not the same as a physical item, which is just cool to have. Yeah. I think there's a difference. And, you know, I don't know. I mean, it's not for us to say. And I find this particular debate very challenging because I actually don't know what the answer is.
Well, maybe we can throw this out to the listening community. And if you think you do have an answer to this, or you have another perspective on this, then please do write in, let us know. We'd love to hear that. And we'll come back to it next week and talk about some of the ways that maybe you tackle this or don't in your household or in your experience. Do let us know. Hello@techpodcast.uk.
You're used to hearing the smooth, velvet sound of Nate's voice drizzled over your ears like a warm eardrum syrup, topped off with the freshly squeezed citrus tang of an Ian Morris opinion. Supporters of the show at patreon.com/UK Tech enjoy second helpings every week. So pull up a chair, find your nearest spoon, and tuck into a sumptuous extra helping with no commitment. If you have any allergies, please inform a waiter.
Well, technology and children is obviously a topic we've covered quite a few times on the show, most recently today, just now, as you'll remember, I'm sure. I recently met Sten Kirkback, and he's the founder of Explora, which is a Norwegian company that makes a GPS-enabled smartwatch specifically for children. As the debate over how much technology children should have is only getting louder, not least of which on our show today, I met up with Sten to talk a bit about the product that his company makes and why he believes this kind of technology is necessary and appropriate.
Our product is called Explora, and it's the child's first mobile phone in the format of a smartwatch. And the purpose of that is allowing the kids in a simple way to allow them to call their parents or text them, or of course also allow the parents to be able to see their location in the parental app.
And I can see one I think you've got here. I mean, it to me, it kind of looks like a slightly larger Apple Watch. You know, I mean, so what are the key differences there between what an Apple Watch does and what yours does?
Yeah. The primary difference is when we launched our product, it was the first SIM-enabled smartwatch that allowed the user to initiate a normal phone call. Most of the smartwatches today are tethered with Bluetooth, so they need a smartwatch in order to be able to make a phone call. Our product is a standalone phone that actually can initiate a phone call itself without a smartphone.
But it's specifically aimed at for children or for parents to give to a child, to a young child.
Yeah, the primary purpose for us was we, as a company, most of our parents ourselves, and we realized that while most parents would like a product for the kids to be able to make a phone call, that product shouldn't be a smartphone. The reason for that is a smartphone also have a lot of other features that is not appropriate for kids. So what we basically did was we removed all the internet access, all the social media, and instead build a smartwatch that were allowed to make phone calls and nothing more than that.
Now, the first time that we met, you told me a very interesting story about how all this got going, about how you lost temporarily one of your children, which resonated with me for reasons that I'll come back to in a bit. But why don't you tell us a little bit about the inspiration for this?
Yeah, I'm a father. I'm a lucky father of four kids. I had this terrible experience once losing track of my firstborn son at a shopping mall. He was away for more than 20 minutes. The only thing I was thinking of was, of course, to be able to connect to him in some way. We were running around in the shopping mall and we couldn't find him. We did at the end, and after that experience, I started to think that we are starting to connect everything in some fashion, but for some reason we have not developed an appropriate product for younger kids in the age before you should buy them a smartphone.
And do you think is an appropriate age then for kids to have a smartphone? At what point do they graduate from an Explorer watch phone to, you know, to an Android device or something like that? Yeah.
We see, and this, I think it's quite similar across most country we have been working in Scandinavia or in Europe, that most parents find the age around 11 to 12 most appropriate to buy a smartphone. And the primary reason for that is the access to internet, social media, cyberbullying, etc. But then at the same time, we also see that from age 5-6, a lot of parents really would like to be able to reach them, but then primary just to be able to call them. And then you also could argue that you could buy an old-fashioned feature phone that allows you the opportunity to just make a simple phone call. But then also a lot of parents would like to have the opportunity to also see their location, which typically is not possible with a feature phone. So that's why we had to start to sort of blend some of the technology from a smartphone, but then remove all the things that is inappropriate for kids. And that was the point we also realized that the format of a watch is very perfect for kids because they often tend to lose things. So while investing in a quite expensive smartphone, it's also a product that the child can very easily lose. So then we saw if we remove the things from a smartphone that is inappropriate, we keep the good features such as location and then blend all that into a form factor which is very suitable for kids, a smartwatch. Then we suddenly had a product that resonated very well with a lot of parents.
I mean, there's a lot of conversation in the media, particularly at the moment, around the amount of technology that young children have. You know, whether that is too much access to gaming. We've had reports this week about the impact that that online gambling or gambling apps have had on kids, particularly, you know, here in the UK. And, you know, while I completely appreciate the sort of the stripped back nature of what you're offering, is there a concern, or have you heard concerns that maybe, you know, this is the kind of gateway drug, if you like, to a 7-year-old having this for a year and thinking, I want a bigger one, or I want the one daddy has or mummy has or something like that?
I think you raised a very, very good and interesting question, because we see One of the reasons why our product resonates very well with parents is that they are concerned about how much time they are consuming on a tablet or a smartphone. And that's why this is a relevant product, because all of that is removed. At the same time, we also get a lot of feedback from the parents that still, even if they use our product, they also have access to some tablets, etc. But I think this is a good way for the parent to introduce the kids to the world of mobile products in a more safe and secure fashion. And still, we are also investigating what is then sort of the appropriate feature we can introduce on our product so it's relevant for the parent from a safety perspective, but also it's relevant for the child themselves, so it's fun and inspiring for them to use. And then you sort of have this ongoing conversation on what is the right content, what is the right type of activity, gaming, etc., on a product like ours versus at the point where you sort of allow them to use a smartphone with all the features that you can find on that.
Mm. And what kind of feedback have you had since the product's been on sale? I mean, do you get letters? I sound like I was in the 80s, sorry. Do you get emails and messages?
Actually, it's a good comment, because I did receive, it was not a letter, it was an email letter from a grandparent. And I think this is one of the moments that really inspire us to go to work, because in our product you are allowed to add, for example, 12 in our one product, 12 different numbers on the parent lap, and only those numbers are allowed to communicate. And the email I received from a granddad was actually that he was the one that was entered into this parent lap, so he could then sort of have a better view on the life to his grandson, because they live very far from each other. And then I realized that this is a brilliant way where technology actually then can bring families closer together, versus someone is saying that, you know, technology also makes us more less with the family time, etc. So yeah, we have some good stories from our parents. And of course, we have also received parents saying to us that, you know, it's so good for us to be able to give them these small messages during the day. We have parents that are traveling a lot to work, etc., and knowing that they are always able to reach out to them is a good thing.
Trying to put myself in the shoes of a massive skeptic, I suppose the number one concern that I might have is, you know, how do you protect the safety of a child if, for example, the parent's phone or device was somehow stolen by somebody who had ill intentions of a child and was then able to track that child's location? Like, how can you address that?
So we are trying to do multiple things on that matter, because the point you're raising is sort of twofolded. One thing is the security on our end, but it's also sort of the security on how the parents themselves are setting up their smartphone. And we are trying to be very proactive on that, and also saying when parents use our product, of course, parents themselves should also have codes and lock their phone, so if they lose their phone, someone has to sort of reopen it and use a code or a password to open the phone, and then you need to open our app, which also can have a code, etc. So there are multiple levels in order to actually access our app in order to communicate with the child. But then again, That goes for all sorts of product you will give your child, that you need to be very careful on sort of how you allow people to communicate with it. And I think also, if you give your child a smartphone, basically everyone that has that number will be allowed to call them or access them, whereby in our case, it's a secure platform between the parental app and the watch, making sure that it's only the one on that list that are allowed to call them. But still, they also need to be cautious of how they are protecting their phone, so it don't end up in the hands of someone that shouldn't access it.
And then, and finally, just give us a bit of sense of your background. I mean, you've got a very relevant history in terms of, you know, why you're the right person to bring a product like this to market and make it big. Give us a sense of what do you do before this?
Yeah. Well, the most important thing is I have four kids, so I'm a dad. But before that, I started working in the telco industry in the late 90s in Telenor and KPN Quest. After that, I worked with Trend Analytics, and in particular, I work with this upcoming trend with wearable technology. And that was when I realized, when I had this experience with my son, that from my background from the telco industry, seeing that, you know, we are about to connect everything we have, our car, our home, our refrigerator, everything is going to be connected in some fashion. Working with the Trend Analytics, I saw that one of the biggest trends would be wearable technology. And having the experience, I saw we have this huge gap, because even though we are working on connecting our refrigerator to tell us which food we are missing, we didn't have anything to connect appropriate in our view to our kids. And matching that with the big trend of wearable technology, and we saw that the form factor of a watch is probably the best suited for kids, it sort of all come together.
Is there anything we haven't talked about that you think might be useful for people to hear?
Yeah, I think we see that this is a very popular product. We see a lot of parents are searching for it. We see a lot of debates about it, which, of course, we think is a very good thing. But I would also advise parents in general to pay attention and do a lot of research when they are looking for products like this, because it's a product that is intended for kids. Security and safety is very, very important, and we see also that there are products coming potentially not setting the security benchmark high enough when it comes to certification, when it comes to compliance related to GDPR, or in general how you store and protect the data that is being collected or used in such solutions. So I think my most important advice for parents in general is to do a lot of research and really understand what sort of product they are investigating, how they work, how the data is being secured and stored, etc.
And for anyone whose curiosity has been sufficiently piqued and is curious to learn a bit more and about the product and maybe looking to getting one, what's the best way for them to find that information?
You can buy our product at both Amazon, you can buy it of course online, Selfridges, and also multiple other retail stores.
Great, Sten, thank you ever so much for your time.
Thank you.
Well, we had a few emails this week, Ian, but I wanted to get to this one in particular because this actually came in last week while you were away in your underground blast-proof ostrich farm or wherever you were.
Manchester, I think they call it, don't they?
Oh, very nice. This email came in from Dragos. He says, "Hi, Nate, Ian, and Andy." So he's covering all bases there.
Nice.
"I have a short take on buying a property based on broadband access. In my previous home, I was a happy subscriber of Virgin Fibre, and when it came to moving house, fibre access was very much a criteria. Still, within 4 miles of Northampton, we found this lovely house within budget, what we wanted, but wired broadband options were limited to ADSL, with an exchange 1.6 million miles away. On a good day, the owner was getting 8 megabits per second. Megabits, not bytes. We did get the house, and we've been there a while, but only after making sure we can get 4G mobile broadband with a 70 gigabyte plus cap. I found a 100 gigabyte a month subscription with 3, and streaming from services like Netflix doesn't count against the cap. Is it ideal? No. 4 megabytes per second is way less than I had on fiber, to the point that a Windows feature update hogs the house bandwidth for 20 minutes. Speed is adequate, especially if you tweak the better DNS like 49 or the new one from Cloudflare on the mobiles. The house is awesome too, so I'm glad we make the step." Now, the reason Dragos, I think, was emailing in, well, I say think, I know for a fact, is because we'd asked anyone if they had made a buying decision or avoided a buying decision on a house purely based on the kind of broadband speeds they get. So clearly, Dragos did buy the house he wanted, but the bad internet was not quite sufficient to warrant not putting an offer in, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, like you, I would be very wary of tying myself into a property where I wouldn't get good broadband. I that would worry me quite substantially. And I wouldn't have said I've made buying decisions on it, but I would say it has made buying decisions very tense.
Yeah, I imagine, and rental decisions for me before I owned a house.
Yes.
I've definitely always asked, what is the broadband option? You know, does it have Virgin? Does it have what have you?
A lot of people don't know, though, do they? Like, a lot of people just stick with, you know, whatever was there, and they might not know that there is actually another alternative.
Not good enough. Not good enough.
Find out. You can find out yourself. In fairness,
I think Rightmove has a thing, doesn't it? Now,
and it's not bad actually. It's got better, I think.
Yeah. Because you'd have everything else. You'd have how, you know, the tax band. You'd have things like that. But why not have internet speeds?
Well, I think I'm right in saying that one of those, I think it's Zoopla, is owned by Uswitch, or what, the company that owns Uswitch. So actually they've got some quite good, there's some good data sharing options there.
That makes a lot of sense. Well, thank you very much, Dragos, for writing in. We'll get to some of the other emails we've got next week. But any more you want to send us in the meantime, always, of course, welcome. hello@techpodcast.uk. And thank you to our patrons supporting us every week. If you're not a patron but would like to become one, you get an ad-free version of the show that's much longer. It has more stories, more talking in it. You can also listen and interact with us live. You get a higher quality download. There's a load of reasons to check out our Patreon. patreon.com/UK Tech. Maybe you can help us finish the month with one extra patron than we had last month, which I'm pleased to say this month we will achieve.
Yay.
So thank you.
Also, send your comments to hello@techpodcast.uk and follow us on Twitter @textmessagepod to keep up to date with the most important UK technology headlines throughout the week. And thanks also to everyone listening to us on our free ad-supported feed. If you've got a minute to leave us a review on iTunes, it's the best way of supporting us without spending a penny.
It absolutely is. We appreciate the free listeners and the reviews you leave and the friends you tell, just as much as we support the financial backing from our patrons. So in whatever way you're supporting us, thank you. And from me, Nate Langson.
And me, Ian Morris.
We'll see you in a week, and Ian will blow his nose.
You've been listening to Text Message with your host, Nate Langson. If you get value from the show, please consider joining our many supporters on Patreon. You can get access to a version of the show every week with no ads, and as much as 40% more discussion every time. There's no obligation, so why not try a month by going to patreon.com/UK Tech or looking for the link in this episode's description.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.